NT-USB.
The Rode NT-USB condenser microphone.
It really kicks the llama's ass.
Oh, I remember that from Winamp. Oh, that's great. That's great. That's the show opening right there.
Welcome to On Taking Pictures. It really does kick the llama's ass.
Why was that?
I don't know.
What does that have to do with anything? Are you looking it up?
Yes.
Like why they said that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it had something to do with
it really whips. It really whips
it really
the
whips
llama's
the
ass.
Llama's ass.
So, hey, next week, just as an aside, we're going to try and do a live show. Isn't
live
that right?
Shows. Yes, we are.
Yeah. We were going to try to do it this week, but apparently there's a little more setup involved. So we'll, I'm sure you can tweet out when you get that. You're going to
Yeah. And it'll actually be through the 5x5 live system.
Okay, so is it like 5x5.tv /live or something?
I think it might be live.5x5.tv or something. But yeah,
okay. we'll tweet
we'll
that out.
We'll find a link.
It is Tuesday, January 12th, 2016. Oh, it's weird hearing myself.
You don't
this.
Like that?
I don't know. Bill taught me a new little trick for monitoring myself in Audio Hijack Pro, which is what we use to record. But it's weird hearing me.
Yeah.
But that's kind of cool. I see what you're saying, though, about keeping me on axis. Because if I go over here...
You notice it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. See, in a way that you probably wouldn't have before.
Probably not.
We're trying to up our audio game.
That's right. Trying to up it.
Always looking to improve.
Yes. Okay. So it is On Taking Pictures. Let's see, January 12th, said that. Jeffrey Sidoris, D.C., Bill Wadman, Brooklyn.
Yeah, what up?
What up? yeah, a lot to talk about today.
We do. We have a ton to talk about. Where do you want to start? You want to start with the sad news of David Bowie?
Yeah. Yeah.
Say what we want to say about that.
I mean, it's sad, but what a way to approach it and to have... prepared for it and gone through it. I mean, there are so many people that either tweeted or wrote articles to the same effect that even his death was a work of art.
Yes.
The orchestration.
How do you see that?
Well, I guess a few days only before he died, they did the video for Lazarus.
Right.
The whole record, according to a couple articles, I'll find links. Maybe you can put them in the show notes. The whole record, Black Star, he knew that this was terminal, that he was going to die. Didn't know obviously when, but knew that it was imminent and wanted to do this project as kind of a swan song for his art, for his fans. You know, it reminded me of when Freddie Mercury got sick. And there's a terrific Queen documentary where there's a scene where Brian May is talking about Freddie came in and said, look, I've got this thing. There is no cure, but I just want to do as much work as we can. I just want to do as much writing and performing as we can in the time I have left.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they were famously bickering back and forth at that point. But then they just sort of...
That solidified the...
Yeah, yeah. Kind of unified and moved forward. And
would you say that it brought it into focus?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I think that there is a certain level of when that kind of stuff happens, you sort of go, you back up a little bit and you say, all right, what are we really fighting over? Let's
right.
go make some music.
Yeah. Who gets the single? Come
yeah,
on.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, and there's a photo set that came out, that was taken, Bowie last photos. He did a photo session, I guess, just a couple days before on his birthday, and he's smiling. He's energetic, and I wonder for these photographs how much that persona that we see in the photographs took out of him. Because again, going back to the Queen documentary, Brian May would say how Freddie couldn't perform at the end for very long. And yeah. he said he would toss back a vodka or two and say, okay, darling, let's do this. And you know, would go sing. And Brian was just in awe. He said, you know, the superhuman level of focus and drive to get this work done. And I wonder if Bowie was the same way in terms of putting every bit of life he had into him. I mean, he had left in him into this final piece of art, this final work, if you will. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think if you know you have a limited amount of time, it changes the way you look at things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I will say, I mean, it's like I'm not amazed by, but I understand the outpouring of grief and loss that a lot of people who really loved his work have put out there, you know. I do think though that the best tribute to it isn't to, like, you know, talk about it a lot, but rather just go listen to some David Bowie music, you know, because that's the ultimate thing. Is, sure. is just sort of get lost again in the thing that made it so special for you in the first place. Heather was telling me the story last night of when she met him, and you know, and she said that his hands were incredibly soft, almost like that's what she remembers, is how soft his hands were.
Hmm.
It's like, it's amazing the things that you remember.
Little details
years later.
That you hold on to. Yeah.
Anyway, just, yeah, it's interesting.
Can you relate to the level at which, and I never met him, obviously, but the level at which his life and his art blended, overlapped, became one? There, it seemed like for on so many levels, there was very little separation between what was his life and what was his art. Maybe on a very personal note, yes.
I think that in many ways he did that on purpose, and that he probably lived a much more simple and private life than he let on.
Mm-hmm.
But he made it seem as if his art was what he really was.
Yeah.
I mean, I was listening to some interviews of with him yesterday, and where he talked about how to him, he's like, I don't like performing. You know, he's like, I don't like spending a year singing the same songs over and over again. To me, it's some mode of a waste of time. That he doesn't like the limelight, that he doesn't, you know, there right. are all these things that he said he didn't like. And I mean, can you think of a more obvious choice for a performer of the 20th century who seemed like he loved the limelight, you know, just the,
right.
just the, I mean, the choices that he made artistically could very easily be seen as somebody who was obviously trying to make a splash and get noticed. Mm-hmm. Right.
Would you say that he sacrificed?
I think he did a good job of not, of keeping his private life private.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was successful for him in the sense that then he could, you know, he could live a somewhat intimate life and then also do the crazy stuff, you know, on stage and be this character that he wanted to be, or change the character that he was so many times through his career. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he's a good example of someone who, didn't lose himself to the fame that came along with success in the stuff he was making, you know, where a lot of people do. I think there's people like him. You could argue somebody like George Clooney. You could argue, you know, there's people who seem like pretty ordinary people, despite the fact that they're rich and famous and powerful and whatever, everything they do, people notice, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty great. I mean, I'm sad to see him go, but he, you know, he left us with what is it, like 29 albums or something.
Right.
There's no loss of David Bowie work for people to enjoy for, you know, the rest of whatever, you know. Yeah, he'll be remembered.
Is there anyone that you can think of offhand that's even It's a tough one in the same realm as Bowie. I mean, there have been comparisons to Gaga. And I mean, you could argue that without Bowie, there would be no Gaga.
I would argue that. And I would argue that I think David Bowie did it with far more class and authenticity than some of the people who do it today.
Well, and that was
for him. It wasn't about
going.
Dressing up. It was, you know, the dressing up was in order to make the show. It wasn't the show. It was in order to sell the show to the audience as something that he was trying to create, you know? I also think you also have to look at the time in which it was done. You know, if you look at Gaga now versus Bowie in 1973 or whatever the hell it was, I mean, it's a very different time. Things are a lot easier now in that way. A lot more, accepting society is of that kind of stuff. If anything, it almost feels cliche to do that kind of stuff now because he's not the person doing it first, you know, that kind of thing.
So it kind of like doing cubism now.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, yeah, but yeah, super. It's great. It's a great painting, but that was done, you know, 100 years ago. And that's when it was interesting, when it was the thing that no one had ever done before.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was just, it's sad. It's, David Bowie.
What a body
of
work, though.
Well, yeah. I mean, and he wasn't afraid to go off in new directions and try new things, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. We were listening to some Bowie yesterday morning, and I personally like the stuff that is a little more melodic, like more ballad, interesting harmony kind of stuff, rather than the straight like rock kind of stuff. Because Conrad made the point. She goes, "That's the stuff that sounds more musical theater." And I was like, "Oh yeah, that's interesting. That's true,
right?"
You know, maybe that's part of why I like it. I don't know. You know, who knows? Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
I think one of my favorite facets of his life and art was that he constantly challenged his audience as much as he challenged himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was never, I mean, he could have done, you know, Heroes and knockoffs of it for the rest of his career and probably had a very successful go as a pop star.
Yeah, but that wasn't his goal, right?
No. And that's the thing is I'm going to challenge myself. So I'm going to expect a little more from you as my audience to meet this challenge. Yeah. And I love that idea. I don't know if it was conscious. I would assume that it is.
Well, I like that idea. I especially like it with someone who it's easy to change up what you're doing when you haven't had the kind of success that he had. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could just say, oh, you know, I tried this. And I mean, there's plenty of artists who never make a lot of, let's just put it bluntly, never make a lot of money who will, you know, change things up, whatever it is, to like change a whim, and they can say, oh, you know, I changed because I, you know, had this other idea. I want to go to another direction. Maybe they were looking for the kind of success that Bowie already had.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to walk away from what you know is sort of a easy money, as it were.
Right.
Here's a good person who I think has done that in some way is Radiohead, right? Radiohead has not made the same record, you know, did not stick with the Bends, did not stick with OK Computer. They just kept changing.
Right.
And in some ways you can argue that they moved away from what their listeners really wanted or could even handle at a certain point.
Right.
But they didn't care. Right. They, to them it was, no, we're just going to try something new. We're going to go in a new direction. And I think Bowie is a good example of somebody who did that. Yeah.
And I don't think it was out of boredom. I don't think, you know, Station to Station came out and he went, okay.
No,
I don't think it was knocking or slighting the work that had come before it. It was always just an evolution, or it seemed to be as an audience member.
Yeah. Or even that he was uninterested in the success of what he had done before. It was always, you know, I did that, whether you like it or not is somewhat irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did that. That's what I wanted to do. If you like it, great. If you don't like it, well, I'm going to try something new. So keep your eye out. You know?
Right.
And I like that way of looking at things versus trying to analyze the market and try to find something that fits. And I know there's arguments on both sides, but like if my dream would be to be far more Bowie-esque than anything else, you know, as far as not caring as much. He didn't seem mm-hmm. like he cared that much what people thought of him. And that's
no,
and maybe that's why he was successful.
Maybe. You know? Yeah. It certainly contributed to it, I think.
Yeah.
And there were collaborations along the way that some unexpected, some, you know, expected, but I love that he could always look around the curve or seemed to always be able to look around the curve.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether it was musically or with technology. Yep. I mean, it was, you know, when he did his ISP, he kind of saw where things were going in ways that few people did.
Sometimes he was too early and sometimes he was wrong, but it, you know, he made bets and he kept moving. You know?
Yeah. I mean, he did a downloadable record in 1999.
Right.
When nobody was doing it.
He's like a creative shark. He just kept moving, you know?
Right. Yeah. I still dig Tin Machine. I think that was a terrific project.
Tin Machine is killing because of Reeves, whatever his name is. That guitar
Gabriel's.
Stuff. Yeah.
That guy
can play. I mean, it's not really even my guitar style that I like, but God, that guy could play.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it was good stuff. Now, artistically, could you see yourself making as many and as dramatic shifts in the type of work that you create?
If I don't, it's not for being scared to make the move. It's more just where my interests lie.
Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm.
I think that part of it is that he was always looking for something else because he was unsatisfied with where he was, you know, like it was always the next thing in order to fulfill some deeper kind of question. So, you know, he was by definition sort of an experimental, some more avant-garde sort of artist.
Right.
Which I definitively am not. So in that way, no, but I mean, it's not that I have any problem with changing things up. You know, it's just that I'm not looking to change as much as he seemed to want to change all the time.
Did the persona have to change along with the music?
Well, in the interviews I listened to, he said, you know, he didn't like performing. And so part of the personas in the masks and the makeup and the dress and all the rest of it was so that he can essentially be an actor on stage
mm-hmm.
instead of having to be him.
And he was a terrific actor.
Early years. Right. Right. Exactly. It just reminds me of the Flight of the Conchords stuff with the 1983 Labyrinth David Bowie, you know?
Oh, right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's sad, but you know, let me ask you a non-art related question that
sure.
That
sure.
If you knew you were dying, would you keep it this secret?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's the one thing that I've been kind of turning over in my head.
Yeah, I think I would. And I don't know anything about what type of illness he had other than they've said it was cancer, but I don't know if he sought treatment or when the diagnosis came in, was there an acceptance and okay, I'm going to be as productive as I can for as long as I can.
Yeah.
And I've wrestled with that. I've wrestled with, would I go through treatment? Sure. And that treatment word is very much in quotes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you and I have both had too much experience with watching people go through that. So the question then becomes, is it even worth going through that?
Yes. Okay.
If the end result is the same place, why fight for another 2 months of pain? Yeah. All that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's situation by situation.
Sure.
But,
and you know what? Maybe his thing was, I want to finish this record and get the record out. And so that's where his mental line was drawn. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. The record comes out on Friday. He's like, okay, I did it. I finished.
I've done what I had to do.
Yep.
Yeah. And maybe it is, you know, it's fascinating to me how this came about. And again, like you said earlier, he's one of those people that you would hear nothing out of for years and then boom, a new project. And then you'd hear he would sort of disappear and go back to the lab and boom, another project.
Yeah. And, you know, and not all of them, in my opinion, hit, but it didn't matter. You know, they were still David Bowie in whatever way.
In his opinion.
Yep, absolutely. And that's okay too. It's just, yeah. It's fascinating. Anyway.
You're not going to love everything you do.
Nope. That's another theme for another time.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about that a little bit. We did. Somebody asked that question. Remember about the shoot that they had that they, you know.
Yeah. What do you do if it just didn't?
Yeah. I think maybe that's a deeper conversation for another time.
What I would ask you this, not just one shoot, but what if
you can get into a series of shoots where you kind of like are hitting a wall?
Yeah. You're just not seeing. That happens all the time. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that next time. Yeah.
All right.
195, hitting a wall.
Yeah. All right. I'll put it down. All right. What else we got?
195. You got it? Okay. You got it. What else we got? Where you want to go?
Well, I want to talk about this size stuff today, but did you want to talk about the PD or you want to save that for another time?
No, I do. Oh, let's give them a little update.
Did you launch?
New episodes of Process Driven, another show, an interview show, launched yesterday with a conversation with Gregory Crudson, which I've wanted to have.
Who?
It's a Polaroid photographer. Does these simple portraits and white backgrounds, flashlight.
Sure.
Yeah. It's good.
iPhone guy, right?
Yeah. It's Samsung. He's got an old Nokia flip that is terrific.
I like those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. Had a wonderful conversation with Gregory Crudson, who, if you've listened to the show at all, you've heard that name mentioned many, many times. And the opportunity came up to sit down with Gregory. And I was thrilled to be able to do it. So it is up. You can find it on SoundCloud, or we'll put a link in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's terrific though. And the response has been really good. Those of you who have listened to it already and written in or tweeted, thank you very, very much.
I didn't know it was out already, or else I'll write about it today when we get offline.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I would appreciate that.
No problem.
What I took away from it, is here's somebody who, and maybe this relates to Bowie, from an external viewpoint, vantage point, is one way, but the reality of it is often very different.
Yeah.
Gregory finds it difficult to look at his own work. Painful, in fact, was the word he used. Yeah. Painful. He talks about there's a moment where, yep, that's good. That makes sense.
Sure.
But then he says that.
He said it was fleeting, right? It was there and it was gone.
Yeah, and gone.
The best you can hope for is that there's like some little moment of peaking where stuff came out exactly the way you wanted it to come out.
Right.
And then you start noticing the flaws.
Yeah. I think there are those things. And then you're right. And then you're back to, I would have done that or maybe. But a terrific conversation. So thankful to Gregory for his time. And more episodes in the works.
More on the way.
I'm doing at least two more this week, maybe three, but it looks like two. So let me know what you think. Listen, subscribe. And if there's someone who you find interesting or you think would make for an interesting conversation, let me know. Email me, tweet me, Facebook me, whatever you want.
I'll let you know what I think.
Oh, you've already let me know what you think, mister.
I thought it was great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good get.
Thank you very much. So good.
All right. So, here's the thing.
Yep.
Here's where I'm coming from.
Where are you coming from, Wadman?
Okay. Photography is by definition sort of size relative.
In what way?
Well, you take a picture and then what size somebody views that picture, it could be that you project it up on a wall as a slide. It could be that you print it out as a 4x6. It could be that you print it out like Crudson at 6x8 feet.
Right.
Right.
Which are gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, and the size of all these things has a real, makes a real difference on how these things feel and your connection to them.
As an audience member.
Yeah. As a viewer.
As a viewer. Okay.
And so a couple weeks ago when Conrad and I were up in Boston, we went over to the Gardner Museum that I talked about a couple weeks ago.
Wait, David has a museum?
Yeah. Yeah.
462 pictures of dancers.
Yeah. Poor guy.
I love you, Dave.
And so there's this painting, El Hielo. It's a, you know, the Spanish dancer, the gypsy dancer.
Oh, I was going to say the Jello.
Yeah, the Jello.
Right?
Yeah, that's
El
good.
El Hielo.
And I'll put a link in the show notes. You can go see it. So now
this
I've
is pretty.
Well, yes. Okay. Now you see. Now go look on the. Go look at the dimensions. Look at the size of it.
90. Oh wow. 93 inches by 138 inch. That's a. Now, that's a lot of paint.
Right. Okay. Now, as a painter, you realize how big that is.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. It's like, you know, what is that? It's 10 feet across. 11 feet across.
Right.
This is a big painting. This is like Delacroix size painting.
Yes. This is what, 2/3 scale of
yeah, she's almost life size.
Yeah.
Right.
Beautiful. Now, I've never seen this piece. I bet it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it is. And part of it is the size of it, right? I mean, if that was a painting that was 18 inches by 10 inches on the wall, it would also be very beautiful, but it wouldn't have the same impact that it does at 8 by 10 feet. Right?
Okay, agreed. Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to flip it this time. Okay. And on the next link down, you'll see this the Dali Persistence of Memory painting, which is the one with the clocks that are
right, which is like 8 by
melting.
10 or something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 9.5 by 13 inches. It's
okay,
tiny.
So small.
Right? To the point where when you actually see it at MoMA, you walk up to it and we were there, I was there last week. You go up to it and you almost think, wait, is this the original? Because it's so small that you can't imagine that the original was ever this big.
Is this
big.
A print?
No, it's the original painting. And you go up to it.
Do you walk up to it and wonder?
Oh, yeah. A print? Yeah. Or yeah, some sort of like miniature copy. This can't be the original, the only one that was, you know, and I was there with Chris Connors. And I said, Chris, you know, Connors, look at this. There's ants on the little pocket watch in the lower left-hand corner, and you can go in, and I think it's printed. It's oil on canvas, but there must be under layers because you know how sometimes when painters paint on panels, you get that like really clean, crisp kind of look to their brush strokes. Mm-hmm, you know what I'm talking about?
It's where like, it almost looks like it's painted on a solid surface instead of seeing the texture of the canvas.
Exactly.
Through.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's like that. And so here's the opposite.
Is the whole painting like that or just that watch face?
Well, the whole painting is like that, but you can really see it when you look down the little sort of orange watch down the left-hand corner is actually like a pocket watch that's sitting there mm-hmm. and there's like ants all over it and the ants are very detailed. And I'm sure he used like one of those little like, you know, two bristle brushes or, you know, whatever the hell people use to do those kinds of details on small paintings. But the point is that you go from 9 by 13 to 9 by 13 feet, and it's a completely different thing. And the same is true, of course, in photography. Crudson, as you mentioned, these big giant things, right? That have impact because they're big. Or what's his name? Who's the guy who does the guy who did the thing down in Brazil with the garbage and the guy I like. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Everyone else is yelling out the name of this guy.
I know who you're talking about.
Okay. He did that movie on Netflix, right? With the garbage and the... Remember, they show him making it all?
Yes.
The big, like, garbage dump?
Vic Muniz.
Thank you, Vic Muniz. His stuff is also printed really big. So the recreations of the paintings... In fact, that there's one at the National Gallery of Art right now where they have... His version of the painting from ripped up magazines on one side of a doorway. And on the other side of the doorway is the original painting on the west entrance of the west building.
Okay.
So at least it was there when I was down there a few weeks ago. And you go look at these things and you think, okay, these things are kind of cool because they're big. Now, here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
With digital photography, with delivery being screens as opposed to prints, how often do any of us decide what size we want somebody to view something at?
Wait, what do you mean? Delivery being screens rather than prints?
People are looking at pictures on websites. They're looking at them on their phone, right?
Okay.
The delivery medium is being chosen by the viewer, not by the artist. And it's, I feel like it's an interesting thing where we've almost lost a dimension of power, as it were, right?
Well,
we've lost
a
decision that we
got
to make.
You could argue that you've lost a dimension, but you've also gained a distribution platform that wasn't there before.
No, absolutely. No. I'm not arguing against the fact that I'm not saying the internet is wrong. I'm just saying I've printed a lot of my images. I printed them big. I printed them small. Some of them I printed big and small, right?
Mm-hmm.
But whenever I see a photograph in a museum or in a book and it says, this Crutzen image is blah, 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 60 by 80 inches down the bottom.
Right. Right.
I always think when I look in the book, I go, well, who cares what size the print that he put in the gallery is? I'm seeing it at 6 by 8 inches, not 60 by 80 inches, right?
Well, I think it's just it's a convention.
Right, it's a convention.
You want to notate the original dimensions. I don't.
Right. And I'm fine with that. I'm saying is that are we losing that whole idea of this is the definitive version of this photograph? It's not a file on a thing. Getting back to episodes 1 through 13.
Right.
It is the print, and the size that you print it at makes a difference.
Sure, it does.
And do we even make those decisions anymore? I've never put my image out, any of my images out there, and said, no, this is the definitive size and this is the size that it should be seen at. And whenever I talk about it, it's going to be referenced that it's 20 by 30 or whatever it
is. Okay, but then why not? Why don't you think in those terms?
I don't know. I just never have before. And that's this realization that I've been having.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Something like Crutzen's work, it has to be that big.
Yeah, and he thinks about it that big, right? I wonder if he's even satisfied with looking at them in a book. Or if it's not really finished until it's a big print.
Not.
Right.
Because in going back to this, and you'll hear him talk about it, but he is so dialed into the experience that I think the larger the print, the closer it gets to his original experience.
Yes. Yeah. But at the same time, last week, we also, Connors and I went to see a Steve McCurry exhibit mm-hmm. at the Rubin Museum, which is an Asian art museum. And they had a whole series of images that McCurry took in India.
Okay.
All the way from, and let me see if they say here, like there was stuff there from the early 90s, late 80s, all the way till today. So
beautiful.
You know, him shooting film, him shooting early digital, him shooting modern digital, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And everything in between. And some of them were small. Some of them were 12 by 18 inch prints, and some of them were pretty big. And both Chris and I agreed that some of them were too big.
Right.
Like if you were within 3 feet of it, it kind of fell apart. You know, it looked crunchy or whatever it is. And it was like, we were looking at them and saying, who decided that they needed to be big? Did McCurry want them to be big? Did the gallery want them to be big? You know?
Well, let me ask you something.
Yep.
Technology and source material notwithstanding. So, so whether you print it at 40 right. by 60 yeah. or 8 by 10.
Imagine that all images are 200 megapixels. So you can do whatever you want.
Technically, it'll still sure. hold up.
Yep.
Aren't there still images that don't work as big images?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that's the thing. Some of them, both technically, they didn't work as big images, and even aesthetically, artistically, from a viewer's point of view, they were very different images. There was one image of a girl sitting on a boat, and I'll see if I can find it. There was
a McCurry image.
Yeah, I'll do a little search. It was like a girl on a boat, and her and whoever was driving the boat, she was like looking backwards, were sort of in the lower center of the image. And it was kind of in a river that they were going down, kind of thing. And from far back, it was a much more sort of panoramic-y kind of feel to it, right? Like you could see the entire environment around them. But when you got up close to it, you kind of just lost all the rest of it because it was so riveting, just the center of it. And to the point where you could have almost cropped the image there. And I know that's an artistic decision and that's a whole other ball of wax. But it was just this, it was this thing where I said, both of us said, you know what, this would have looked better and felt better and been more impressive if it was smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I know that there's even economic factors for selling. You know, bigger prints sell for more money, and there's all these kinds of like weird things where it doesn't cost that much more. I mean, yes, it costs more to make a big print, but it doesn't cost as much more as, you know, the differences between prices that
yeah,
people
probably
set,
not but, relative to the price.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's like this marketing thing about larger prints too, which is just kind of fascinating to me. And I was wondering what you thought about the idea of deciding what size an image should be, and if that's something we should even worry about now, or we have to let it go because that's the way the world's going.
Well, it's certainly an interesting topic from the standpoint of, at least on a consumer level, on a print your own work and try and put it in your Squarespace site to sell level.
Sure. Yep.
You're very much limited by the size of the paper, the size of the printer.
Sure. Yeah.
Unless you're outsourcing to, you know, someplace else, like,
or you had the giant thing that you had at your old house.
Right. Or the giant, you know, 48 inch, whatever. But there are still practical limitations that are going to influence, I think, what size you print at.
Yeah. But remember in the Genius of Photography, I think it was Alex Soth or one of those people, and he was showing a bunch of images, and they were unrolling prints that he was preparing for a gallery show. Mm-hmm. And they opened one up and he goes, yeah, no, that's too big. And they cut it up right in front of them because, right, you know, they want to destroy the stuff that isn't going to be used. So it's not, you know, taken and used for other stuff.
Right.
But there was this moment where he was like, no, that's definitely too big.
And I wonder, somebody like Alec or, you know, some of the other people.
By the way, I found the link. I'm going to put it in Skype here and in the show notes. This is the image I was talking about.
Wait, what? Which one?
I put the image in the show in Skype.
Okay.
So you can see that.
I wonder if somebody like Alec or anyone else that we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know how when you I don't know if you've ever done this, when you paint a room, sometimes you'll hang a little swatch on the wall and let it sit there for a week or so and see, yep, if that's the color you really want to go with.
Yep.
So I wonder if it would be helpful to hang a few different sizes of, yeah, a print and see which one you keep coming back to as the right quote unquote print,
sure,
the right size,
yeah,
print.
Absolutely. Yeah. But but it's interesting that this is the stuff that you used to think about, because when you were printing, you would go into the dark room or have prints made because that's the way you finally looked at the finished image. Mm-hmm. Where now we look at the finished image as a file on our 12 inch computer, our 4 inch computer, our 27 inch computer. You know,
right,
it's those are all very different experiences. And especially like looking at somebody's work on a website, it's very different than seeing it in reality. If they're all the same size on a website, but like one guy normally prints his things as these tiny little 5x7s that are on the wall that you have to walk up to and really like look inside of, mm-hmm, and the other guy does what Crutzen does and it's the size of a wall. His picture is the wall.
Right.
It's just, I don't know. It's like a whole new thing that I'm thinking about that I hadn't thought of before.
Do you see yourself moving to different sizes of work in light of thinking about this? Or are you still thinking in terms of, well, this is what I can have printed or this is what I print myself? What's governing where you're going with this? Is
it more the technical or
more the aesthetic?
I mean, I think that there's a certain technical limitation in the sense that I'm an anal enough photographer that if I print it big, I need it to look good big.
Mm-hmm.
And like with my 22 megapixel camera, the limit of me knowing that it's going to look really good is, I don't know, 20 by 30, 30 by 45, somewhere in like that, mm-hmm, sort of range.
But then something maybe like Motion, your Motion series,
don't,
because those
big,
are a little more, they don't look good big.
They look terrible big. There's
really?
An example. I've printed I've printed those as 8x10. I've printed them as like a 20x24 kind of size. I've printed them 16x20, and I printed one at like 20x30 kind of size. I didn't like it at all.
The 20x30.
Yeah.
Was it falling apart technically, or was there something about the composition?
Those are sort of grainy images anyway, because of the amount of processing to get them to look that way. So, it's that size, because those images are so sort of abstract and just sort of weird shapes anyway, you get to a point where it's so big that you can't get the whole thing. You don't sort of eat the whole thing in one bite, and you sort of lose a sense of what the whole image is. And you're just kind of like looking at little shapes in it. I found that, like a 16 by 19 is the best, or not 16 by 19, like 16 by 20 or something like that. Well, is like the ideal size. So I don't know. It's just, something I was thinking about.
Interesting. Yeah. I I'm curious, those of you who are listeners, and are printing your work either yourself or having it done, first of all, I'd love to know. Right in, podcast@ontakingpictures.com. And I'd love to know, are you printing yourself? Or are you having it done? I know Danny just got Danny, what did you get? A Pixma 100? Did you get the 100 or the 10? I think you got the 100. So are you printing yourselves or having it done? And how are you deciding sizes? Is it purely based on the size of the paper that you have available, or are you doing tests to see what size works best for what print?
Yep. It's like a whole other thing that I hadn't thought of that I'm going to start thinking about more.
Well, and it's also, I think, relative to books. I mean, I don't have a lot of original prints by people, or not original prints, but, you know, prints by other people, but I do have a lot of books. So while I would love to see and have seen, for example, some of Helmut Newton's work large, I'm limited to the whatever 9x12 size of the book, and I still enjoy the work, but having seen it large.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, having seen what he wanted to print them at large, there is kind of a, had I not seen them that big, maybe there wouldn't have been.
The pen show we all saw down in D.C., I mean,
right.
Those pictures are not that big, 11 by 14, you know, for a lot of
some,
those prints.
Yeah.
But they were fine that size. In fact, they were really nice that size.
I agree.
And if those were blown up to some big thing, it just wouldn't have the same impact, you know?
I think very few of those pictures would work large, for me anyway.
Yeah, or would gain anything by size. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, there are mm-hmm. images. There are certain images that are asking for real estate, and then there are others that are asking for subtlety, you know?
And how do you determine the line for each? What are the determining factors?
I feel like that's one of those things where you kind of look at it and you go, too big.
You know it when you see it.
Yep.
Or you don't know it when you see it.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, just interesting.
Hmm.
See, it's an interesting topic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. if I could afford a bigger printer, I would print bigger images.
Or you could have afforded to ship a giant printer across the country. How much would it have cost to ship that across the country?
$400 or $500.
Yeah, it's worth $400 or $500.
Yeah, at that point, that printer. Yeah.
What'd you do with it in the end?
Sold it.
Oh, okay. All right, one last thing we need to talk about today.
What?
Are you really going to go back to a digital SLR?
I believe so.
Okay, so not a huge half hour discussion, but just you were a firm believer in the.
I love my Fuji. I love my X Pro. What I'm finding, a couple things. Number one, I want to shoot more outdoors, and it rains a lot more, frankly, than it does in California, and my X Pro is not weather.
You mean water falls from the sky?
That's right. It's a terrific camera, but it's not weather sealed. The X Pro 2 is supposed to be weather sealed, but after a 4-year product cycle, I'm not hugely impressed with what the X Pro 2 has to offer.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a little bit larger sensor and. Yeah, it's supposed to have a better viewfinder with a faster refresh rate, but it's still not that large, beautiful viewfinder from the X-T1.
I got you.
Still no 4K video.
So it's features for you more than handling.
It's a combination. The thing that's really got me excited, frankly, and I want to see one and feel it in my hand, is the Nikon D500.
Right.
The D300 that I had was leaps and bounds the most comfortable camera I've ever held.
Yeah.
In terms of button layout and ergonomics and placement. And so if the 500 is close to that, it's the same price as the X Pro 2. But it's got, you know, the tilty flippy screen and dual card slots and 4K video and, you know, 8,000 focus points and all that.
I've always found SLRs to feel more comfortable, far more comfortable in my hand than smaller mm-hmm. ones.
Even the 750, the D750 is another terrific camera.
Yep.
And it's full frame.
Or even the 610.
Or the 610. Yeah. Those, I don't know. I like the grip. I like the, because I don't have a strap typically on my camera. I do have a neck strap, but I typically wrap it around my wrist.
Yeah.
And I just hold the camera at my side. I like having a little bit more to kind of curl my fingers around. So I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see the 500. Frankly, I'd love to see the new Pentax full frame that's coming out. That looks like a beast.
Oh, are they making a new one?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
You know, I don't know. And then, you know, you're looking at the, that new Phase 100 megapixel.
yeah. I mean, if I had to lean towards one, it would probably still be the Pentax, although it has its own issues.
Hasselblad is apparently announcing their, 100 megapixel. It's probably built on the same sensor as the Phase.
Oh, I'm sure they're all in the same Sony sensor. I'm sure I'd be willing to put money on it. All of these things are amazing. This weekend I was shooting on an old 7-year-old Phase P25 Plus.
It corresponds to, it's a 25 megapixel?
It's like 25 megapixels,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
They are, 25 megapixels on that camera gives way more information than the 22 megapixels on my Canon, you know?
Okay. Wait a minute, Wadman.
Yeah, go ahead.
You alluded, if not outright said,
yep,
that the photographer has as much to do with the medium format look as the hardware. So
true.
How is it?
What I'm saying is, if somebody says this picture looks like it was taken on medium format and all they're seeing is a 1,000 pixel version on the internet,
mm-hmm.
then it's probably more the photographer than the actual camera. But there's a certain level, if you're shooting at ISO 50 and you're using strobes, and I mean, I'm talking about like per pixel sharpness and the ability to crank around the exposure in a raw file and that kind of stuff. It's got more room to breathe in post-processing. Okay. And that
so
kind
you,
of stuff.
Are you saying, I'm going to ask you for a definitive answer here, man.
Final answer.
Final, yeah, you don't get a lifeline.
I don't get to phone a friend.
Right, put the phone down.
All right, what are you saying?
Are you saying to me that a 7-year-old Phase IQ 250 looks better than your, 2-year-old Canon 5D Mark III under the same shooting circumstances?
Yes. But wow. You're also talking about, you know, fancy Hasselblad lenses. You're talking about shooting at ISO 50 because mm-hmm, you can't mm-hmm. really shoot above that. You can shoot at 100 and still be okay. So, I mean, it's a much more limiting factor. You don't have autofocus. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons
and
why.
And what body was this on?
This was on a 555, I think it is. So on a Hasselblad mm-hmm. motorized body.
Would you consider going that route?
No.
No.
No. Because a lot of the work that I have to do professionally, I can't have that much light, you know, or I'm not carrying around that much light with me and mm-hmm. I don't want to have to, a lot of situations I have to shoot at 800 or 1600 or, you know what I mean? Like I want to be able to do that.
It's just not possible with like the older.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible. It's just not practical. You know, if I had that camera and I carried around a bag of lights and could set them up everywhere and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, you could do it, but mm-hmm. I just don't have any interest in that. That's why the CMOS medium format is actually interesting to me, because you can shoot a high ISO and you get a lot of the benefits of that. But, you know, there still is something about the CCD, the old CCD medium format sensors. There's just there's a color thing about them. They're just very accurate color wise, like skin tones and that kind of stuff.
We talked the other day when you were shooting with this thing. Do you want to share that about the white balance and the green and all that?
Okay. So that's weird.
That was kind of weird, right?
Right. So I brought home some raw files and opened them up in Lightroom or Camera Raw. And it was saying that the white balance temperature as shot, when you set to as shot, it was 3350 and a really heavy green tint.
And where were you shooting these?
Under strobes.
So, wow. So it should have been dead 5,500, 5,000,
somewhere around there. Yeah. 5,600, somewhere around there. But the interesting thing is when I brought them into, Capture One, cause I stuck them in Capture One just to see if it gave me the same thing. Mm-hmm. It said that they were at 55, even though in Lightroom, if I put them at 55, it would look terrible. If I left it as shot, the white balance, it looked great.
Weird.
Yeah, so must be some metadata format thing that gets crunchy. It's not it's not like any sort of real deal. It was just more of an interesting wait a minute, is this thing shifting that much? There's also lots of issues apparently if you use tilt shift lenses and stuff with those sensors the way they are, if the light is coming at the sensor from a slightly oblique angle, if you're using a tilt shift where you're kind of bending the light a little bit, mm-hmm. you'll get color casts because the sensor gives you different data depending on at what angle the light is hitting it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's all kinds of.
Is that a limitation of the CCDs, or has that happened with CMOS as well?
I think it has something to do with the old CCDs like that. And so, there are all kinds of, and you can only shoot one picture a second, and you pretty much have to be tethered. And interestingly enough, we were actually tethering because he didn't have his desktop at the studio we were working in. We were tethering to an old PowerBook G4 17 inch.
Oh.
And the reason why is that an old 17 inch. Yeah. G4.
Oh,
yeah.
Geez.
Because apparently the FireWire port on more modern MacBooks didn't put out enough juice to run the back.
Huh.
And then if you wanted to use those computers, you had to put a little, a power bump thing in line in the FireWire cable that added power
between
to the,
book and the camera,
into the wall. Isn't that weird?
Yes.
Something I'd never seen. I hadn't heard of before. I was like, wow, that's fascinating. Anyway, it was interesting. It's great. It's I love shooting with those big cameras, and it feels different to shoot with those cameras. Just because it's a real, feel to it. Especially the motorized ones with a nice back on them. But
I'm not
going out to buy one.
If Apple put out a Pismo today with modern innards, I would buy one in a heartbeat.
That's the one you like?
The old Blackbirds? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, really?
Oh, yeah.
See, I was always a fan of the Tiebook. That was sort of my design aesthetic. In fact, we have one in the house. If anybody is an Apple laptop...
You have a Tiebook in the house?
I have a Tiebook in the house that works. So if anyone out there is an Apple collector that we've been looking to get rid of just because it sits in the closet and doesn't do anything, it's an 800 megahertz G4 Tiebook, and it works, and it's got a nice clean install of, 10.4? What is that? Is that Tiger?
I wonder if somebody could gut that thing and
stick new innards in it?
Put one of the new innards in.
The screen would still suck, though, right?
Yeah, but you could pop the screen, put another one in there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you could. I mean, I guess you could. Anyway, so if anybody is interested in that, and
I do like those
pay
too.
Shipping and
I'll
stuff,
just
let us know.
Square it off.
Oh yeah,
just
it's
a
nice
block.
And the way when the screen came down, the little levers to click the screen and just kind of pull out with magnets.
Yeah,
there's something tight about that book. That was the beginning of that was the first sort of modern laptop to me, where widescreen and it felt really kind of solid and.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't plasticky. Anyway, yeah, that's interesting. All right, so back to digital SLR. I'll be interested to see where you go with that.
Yeah, I who knows when they actually come out and you can see one in your hand, feel one in your hand, rather.
Not anytime soon, you think?
I don't know what the ship dates are on them. I heard February, but then some other site reported March.
Okay.
Which seems, I mean, if you're going to announce it, why don't just release it?
That seems really late.
I don't know. And yeah. You know, maybe the X Pro 2 in the hand and the usability, maybe that's good. I don't know. Maybe the X-T2 is going to be good. Who knows?
Yeah. All right. One little update from...
Yeah, filed under duh.
A very early topic of our show. If you've been listening for 4 years now, there was a picture that a macaque monkey took of himself, grabbed the camera out of a nature photographer's hand, turned it on himself, pressed the button, and took this picture. And people argued that the monkey has copyright to the photo, and therefore the guy can't sell it. Apparently, a U.S. district judge said in a tentative opinion on Wednesday that while Congress and the president can extend the protection of law to animals as well as humans, there's no indication that they did so in the Copyright Act. Therefore, because the monkey's not human, he can't hold copyright.
This seemed like a perfectly logical use of taxpayer money.
Yeah, well, there's also the question of, does that mean that the photographer retains the thing or that no one has?
Maybe it's just in the public domain.
Yeah, and that's sort of interesting. Here we go.
This just in, grapefruits can't buy real estate.
The Wikipedia contends that no one owns the copyright to the images because they were taken by an animal, not a person.
Right.
So anyway, just interesting update for those of you out there who are like that picture. It is a cute picture.
This elephant will be representing me in the court case today. Yeah. I don't think we can allow that. Judge, sidebar.
Sir, my podcast host is a clown. Can I
yeah, and a wooden one at that. Yeah. Ugh. Gosh. People. Come on, people.
All right, you got anything else?
Keep your eye on the ball for God's
sake. Hey, there's a meetup next Monday in New Jersey.
Next Monday.
Yeah.
Right.
In Lambertville, New Jersey.
Lambertville, New Jersey.
Anton's at the Swan, which is Chris Connor's restaurant.
Anton's.
This would be January 18th at 3 p.m. In Lambertville. There's a post that Freddie Clark put up at the top of the Google Plus community of ours. If you're interested in going, 3 o'clock. We're gonna do. Apparently, they're gonna plan on doing some portraits.
Wait, are you gonna be there?
I'm thinking of going. Yeah. I'm closer than you.
I will go. It's going to be kind of depending on weather.
Okay.
I don't want to be driving in snow.
That's a long drive for you.
Yeah, it is.
So, you know, if you don't get this one, I'll see if I can take care of it. And then we'll, you know, cause you're coming up here in a few weeks anyway.
I'll be there for, yeah. Somebody asked, who was it?
That's a nice sound you're making. What? His name is Roger.
No, it was, who was it that asked? Wasn't Justice?
Judd Apatow.
Judd Apatow asked, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Judd Apatow said, "Hey, when you coming up?" No, it was Rena. Rena asked about 128 in New York. January 28th is the opening of Gregory's new body of work, Gregory Crudson's new body of work, Cathedral of the Pines at the Gagosian Gallery.
Yep.
So
he's going to have a busy day that day.
Yeah, it's going to be a busy day, right?
Yeah.
Or does he just chill and then show up? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
Either way, come up to New York. You'll come to that, won't you?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So that'll be fun.
Shake the man's hand.
Right. And, you know, if somebody wants to give me tickets to Hamilton for the 29th, that'd be good.
Nice try.
No.
Yeah.
Lin-Manuel.
Yeah.
No? He listens, right? He's a
You know what time it is? It's showtime.
That's right.
That's a New York City reference, by the way.
I'm just, you know, I'm not giving away my shot.
Don't like that song. I like a lot of songs. That's not one of the ones I like.
It's a good record.
It is. It's good. It's an interesting mix of like the hip hop thing and traditional, sort of modern, you know what it feels like? It feels like Jesus Christ Superstar for the modern age to me.
Okay.
And that's not a rip. It's just sort of like it's that kind of thing where it's like, oh, well, we haven't done a rap musical, so we're going to do a rap musical. You know?
It's not throwing away my shot. That's what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like my country, I'm young, scrappy, and hungry. Yeah, I like that song.
Yeah. No, it's cute. I like some of the other ones better, though.
So anyway, so that's 128, 129. If folks are around, I would love to meet you in person and, you know, go wander around, go get a coffee, go get a bagel, something. I don't know. What do you guys do there?
Jeez, I thought you were going to hang out with me. Whatever.
I'm going to hang out with you. But what if we can meet other people too? That'd be great.
Other people. There's other people in the world? People listen to this?
You have no idea how true that statement is. all right. What else we got?
Assignments. What do we have from last?
Did you want to settle on this one, or you said?
Character. We said character. I think
character. In honor of the passing of David Bowie.
I just spelled character wrong.
Character.
But I'm gonna fix that. There you go. Character in honor of David Bowie.
Someone has character.
How do people do last week, though? I like these renewal ones.
I think they were terrific. Look, every week, not only are there really good assignment photos, but it's just seeing how people see the world.
Yeah.
And I love this. Let's see. Some pictures from St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans to inspire a NOLA meetup. Jonathan. Jonathan, New Orleans meetup. Could actually happen. What's it? January, February, March 14th through the 18th will be in New Orleans. So if anybody wants to meet up, I'd love it.
Okay. You should do that.
Anyway, Tom from Michigan.
I like Florian's discussion about, he said, Jeff and Bill made me realize that the reason they talk so little about their gear is because they found the perfect setup. I believe my problem is that I had the wrong gear. Do you think that it's that you found the right setup? Like, you and I don't really buy that much gear as a general rule of thumb. Do you think it's because we found the right setup or just because we're cheap?
I think I found something that worked for what I wanted to do with it. And now my use case is changing.
So you're going to find something new.
I shoot with my iPhone 95% of the time.
Yeah.
And it's not just because it's with me. I actually really like it. And I think it does a terrific job for the type of things that I shoot.
Right.
Jacko, love that shot of that.
The biker and the
bicyclist.
Snow?
Yeah. Not me, man.
The shot of that Kathy Hatfield put up a picture of Wayne at the hospital. Did you see this with the pacemaker?
I did. Wayne, get well.
Yeah. I'm thinking about you.
I hope it's nothing serious, and I hope you'll make a full recovery. I hope you're okay.
Dave Lawrence also makes a photo book of his family's adventures, special moments in everyday life each year. So it's kind of a good idea.
Like, cool.
Yeah, make a book of your images each year, and then you have something to show for it.
I dig McNulty's photo of the guy walking in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I can't decide if the car
walking
is distracting
in Wisconsin.
Me. Wow. I can't decide if I would marquee that car out or not.
No, got to keep the car. It would be better if the car was like black or something, but if you take the car out, there's not enough.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to see it. It's maybe it is. It's maybe it's just too bright. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Merrick. Terrific picture. I like this. Maybe we can talk about it next week or post some other stuff and we'll talk about that. But I like the composition. I like the small figures down at the bottom. That's nice.
Well, there's some new stuff in the crit wall, so we'll do some of those next week.
Yeah. Overall, again, you guys know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I love seeing it. We both do.
So who do you got for photographer of the week? This is you.
Photographer of the week is another kind of sad story. A couple weeks ago, we lost Mark LaGrange in an accident.
What happened?
I heard a couple different stories, but what I think happened was his cart, like a golf cart type thing. He was at a resort, and it went off this cliff.
What? How the hell did that happen?
Well, I don't know.
That's terrible.
According to a Spanish newspaper, he and his family were driving a golf cart outside of their hotel when the vehicle suddenly crashed to the ground from a height of about 4 meters. It's believed that Saskia Deckers, Lagrange's girlfriend and stylist, who was also involved in the accident, as well as their son Lee, but little is known about their condition. So it was very sad. Very sad.
Yeah, that's very sad.
So Mark Lagrange is our photographer of the week. And if it's Lagrange, I'm sorry, but I would imagine it's Lagrange. Belgian photographer. Beautiful, sort of sumptuous work.
Yep.
Is that fair?
Yes, yes.
If you are familiar with someone like Paolo Reversi, this work will be familiar to you. Even some
I
of...
I figured out who it
Helmet.
Is.
Huh? Who was it?
Erwin Olof.
Erwin Olof. Okay.
Right?
Yep.
You see that?
Yep. Okay. I know who you're talking about. We were talking about something before, and neither one of us could remember who it was, Erwin Olof. Another terrific photographer.
Yeah, but it's a similar... I feel like a similar aesthetic.
Yes.
The
yes.
stuff that they make, yeah.
So
except Mark uses more naked women or mostly
Mark,
naked women.
Mark uses a lot of nudity. Yep. He released a book earlier in 2015 called Senza Parole, which is absolutely lovely. And Tenoyas, the publisher, were kind enough to send me a copy of it. And it is absolutely gorgeous. I'll do a more lengthy review, but stunning body of work. And one of the things that I like about his work is the contrast between the environments or the settings that he's taking these pictures and the antiquity and the roughness of his surroundings and the beautiful subject matter in terms of these figures that he's presenting.
Yeah.
Is that something?
Yeah. There's a contrast, right, between mm-hmm. and it's generally like, you know, obviously these beautiful women, like in these situations that, I mean, their beauty stands out against what's going on behind them.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great shot of the elephant and him, and
right?
That's gorgeous. She's holding onto the elephant's tusks.
Holding onto the tusks and kind of hanging there. Yeah, toes just barely touching the ground.
Oh, that's amazing.
Look beautiful shot. They remind me of...
Is that your lawyer?
What?
Is that your lawyer in the shot?
The elephant? Yeah. Yeah. Moonlighting for extra cash.
It's what he does in his free time.
In addition to an attorney, I'm also the extra in Mark LeGrand. Yeah. His stuff... Do you know Sir Lawrence Almatadema?
No.
You know that painter? His stuff sometimes reminds me of the quality of light and some of the backgrounds of his work.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm looking at some now. Yep. This guy seems to be from very much that sort of classical revival school mm-hmm, of painting, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So I can put a link in. Keep talking.
So just beautiful work. I'm not a huge fan of... There's a fine line when nude photography becomes just gratuitous.
Okay. Do you think he's on one side of that line?
I think he's on the side that I like his work. I think he's on the side where it doesn't seem overly gratuitous. There are a couple shots where I'm not a fan of the composition, or I think there are too many figures. As a general rule, I think his photographs work best, especially his nudes, when there are fewer subjects, one or two subjects, rather than, you know, some of the compositions, there are, you know, 8, 10, 12 people. And it doesn't work for me.
Too many notes.
Too many notes, yeah. but the body of work in Senza Parole is really stunning.
And I put a link to some videos of his work too, which are kind of interesting.
There's a behind the scenes of Senza Parole. I think there's also a behind the scenes of his first book, which was called, or not, I don't know if it was his first book, his previous book, which was called Diamonds and Pearls. Also a really beautiful body of work. I think this is fantastic. And I think that there are a few color pictures in this body of work that are really gorgeous, but by and large the black and whites are lovely, and the and the color that he is using is really pulled down and desaturate.
Yeah, I like it.
There's a shot. Let me see if this pastes in. Does that paste in?
Let me see. Yes.
Black woman parrot on her foot with a turban.
Oh, I do not see that one. Let's see. I'll find it. Oh, I see it. Yep. Got it.
Beautiful.
Wow, look at her.
Isn't that stunning?
God, she's gorgeous. I
mean, gorgeous.
The whole shot is gorgeous.
Yeah, it's lovely. Yeah. So take a look. Marc Lagrange, Senza Parole, and his previous book, Diamonds and Pearls. Both books still available. Senza Parole is the more recent of the two. But that's our photographer of the week.
Good choice.
Thank you.
If you want to get a hold of us, podcast@ontakingpictures.com. And what else? We are on Twitter and Instagram at Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris. And 347-687-9411 if you want to leave us a voicemail. You got anything else?
No. If the live thing works out.
Yep. We will tweet it out.
Can people tweet in and we would see it then, wouldn't we?
Oh, yeah. People could tweet while we're live and comment on the show.
Oh.
Or we could if we wanted to create some sort of, what's it called?
Like an IRC type thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Chat thing.
Is that built into their back end?
That's a little crazy.
It is. But you could listen live, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. So we'll try to do that next week.
Thank you for listening, everyone. Yeah. Go check out PD. I think you'll enjoy it. Please.
Yep. Go listen to that. And then, yeah, stop the show. Well, no, they've already listened to our show.
Yeah, see. Yeah, so stop.
All right. Finish the show and then go process driven. All right. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something. This way, say what you want to say, though I know your words will lay me out, so I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I have for too long, it's clear to me this way. Say what you wanna say. I know what you will say. We'll leave.